Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Hi,
Long
Michael.
time no
Just
see.
long time to see. Yeah, we've last time I just try to remember. Last time was at the Holacracy Forum in Amsterdam. We were sitting in a cramped little was it your little flat, and lively sounds outside from the street, and we improvised a little microphone stand with a bottle of mineral water or something.
I
It was
still
fun.
have the picture. I still have the
Yeah,
picture.
we do.
Yeah.
That was
Yeah,
good.
it was good. It was awesome. Yeah. And time has flown, and you have now published a book on Holacracy, and that's one of the reasons why I also wanted to talk to you, talk with you, to just discuss, like, you as a you are one of the master coaches in Holacracy, and also I would say quite prominent figure in German kind of like community, Holacracy community, and maybe even in Europe and the world. I don't know how you position yourself, but definitely I am really happy that there is more and more publications on Holacracy. So that's why I would love to have a chat with you about this.
As you said, I finally managed to publish a book on Holacracy, not the one I intended to write, to be honest. The one I intended to write was more like a practice, like a manual for practitioners. That was the idea, but other things happened in between, which so there was in Germany, there's a pretty well-known organizational sociologist by the name of Stefan Kühl. He's a professor for organizational sciences or sociology in at the Bielefeld University in last year. This yeah, 1 year ago, I think. Yeah, in March last year, he published two books. And presenting his research on Holacracy. And they did some research on five Holacracy powered organizations. And he wrote a book. One is Holacracy Functions and Consequences of a Management Model, together with Van Mika Suur Ngamnyam. Interesting name. And that is kind of the more scientific version. And then there he did a kind of a shorter, more concise version where he's that is more directed towards the public. It's not so much meant for the scientists, but more for the wider audience, kind of sharing what they learned from the research. And that is I'm not sure what exactly the English title is. There is an English translation now. But if you just translate it, it's shadow organization, agile management, and unwanted bureaucratization.
Okay.
Holacracy, in his idea, leads to shadow organization and unwanted bureaucratization. That's kind of right there in the title. So, of course, I had to read that book, and it was quite harrowing. Read for me as a former practitioner perspective. Of course, as an Holacracy aficionado, and of course as a person who's earning their livelihood with that kind of stuff. So to read, like, okay, how all the ways Holacracy is horrible and does not work, and read about those, and that was where it was difficult, and and it left me wondering, is that all? Because I know from experience there's more to the story. And my book was a response in the sense that yes, there is more to the story. Please also include those. Not that everything is wrong that you wrote. There were some misconceptions in my understanding and some misinterpretations of the practice. But also valid, very valid points. And So I figured it would be worth to set the record straight and also offer a perspective of a practitioner of the method to the picture, especially also for those scientifically inclined people who only read those things, and also for those who have a blind worship of science. To also say, okay, maybe we need to push back on a few things here too, if we value truth and if we value balanced views. So I did that. So I wrote this book, called it Understanding Holacracy, Criticism, Science, Practice. In German, it's called Holacracy Verstehen, Kritik, Wissenschaft, Praxis. And I published it I found a publisher who was willing to do the book and was interested. So it's quite So it's got the badge of credibility from scientific publisher, and Schäfer Pöschel is the publisher. So they do management books and stuff like that. So it was important to me, although. It was a bit painful. It's because it costs a little more than a usual book would cost, because it's a special literature, kind of literature that goes for X amounts of euros. So but I thought, no, it's important to make a statement and
Obviously.
not just do it self-publishing and oh, it can be like dismissed easily or something. So that was important to me to say, no. This is serious stuff we're doing here, and it deserves serious attention from and the right kind of form. So I wrote this book. So as I said, it's not the book I wanted to write, because it doesn't teach people holacracy, only implicitly, by like showing, okay, what not to do. What to avoid with the pitfalls that were pointed out partially by the research, but also added some pieces to the puzzle, like what other patterns I saw and what to do about them, most importantly, right? So it's not just okay, no, whether this criticism is right, this criticism is wrong, but also, okay, if this is right, how can we avoid that trap, the particular one that is discussed or whatever.
Or be aware of it, right? So you can choose how you respond to that. But I wanted also to bring here one book that was published also, I think, last year, or was it already in 2022? Nikolai Foss, you know the guy, professor from Copenhagen Business School. He published together with a co-author a book. I can show you. I have it here. And you probably, if you don't know,
Oh yeah, right. I have it there unread on my stack of
you
unread
have, yeah.
books. I thought, okay, I should look at that at least.
I
Why
mean,
manage it better? Okay, yeah. Why
I'm
do
more
we
than sure that when you read this book, you will have another book published soon as a response.
I doubt it, having been.
Because they are like they are quite critical about not only holacracy, but like they kind of frame it together, which is already in itself kind of like a very simplified approach. They put together what they call like the narrative of bossless organizations, like, and they call it the perils of the bossless company. Perils, like.
Let's be fair, there are perils, and there's a lot of ways to do it wrong. I mean, there's so many ways of doing it wrong, in fact, and many have tried and have failed. And Holacracy is one of the survivors in this space, I would say, that has not like just totally failed or something, but is doing okay, in my opinion, and has really evolved, or brought forth some coherent response to all the challenges of doing self-organization or self-management in companies. So But that's just my take. I'm highly biased, of course.
So let's I would love to take those three corner keywords, like these cornerstones that you have as a subtitle of your book, criticism, science, and practical aspects. So if we start from the criticism, so what is, in your opinion, the kind of like most, let's say, most kind of prevalent criticisms of philosophy?
Well, I can give you a quick list and then we can see where we want to which ones we want to look into more deeply. So the list of the criticisms I look at also in the book are hyperformalization, it's called. So too formal, too bureaucratic, too many rules, too many structures, and so on. Role over soul, formality ruins. Employees hiding behind a multitude of roles, stifling of initiatives, doing service by the holacratic book, erosion of holacratic meetings, inflexibility of holacratic organizational principles, i.e., the constitution, the formation, of course, of shadow structures in holacratic organizations. And I throw in a bonus, which was not in Kuhl's book, more complexity due to more roles. And as you can, I see you nodding here on the video feed. As you can tell, these are not too easily just to be dismissed, but they have to be answered and looked at earnestly and responded to thoroughly. So yeah, any of those jump at you.
Some of them are quite, known criticisms. Some of them are new to me, or I haven't, like, at least phrased them in in such a manner. I guess for me it would be very interesting, the shadow game, or what, how you call it, like
Shadow structures in holocratic
shadow
organization.
structures. Yeah, I think this might be quite interesting take. If you would elaborate on that one.
So basically Kuhl's observation is that holacracy tries to bring clarity to organization by formalizing roles and accountabilities and by writing down policies and all this stuff. And so he says the promise of the holocrats is that the formal and informal structure can be m made largely congruent in their organizational model through permanent optimization. The basic idea is that all central expectations in an organization should be formalized in such a way that everyone can see them so that no shadow structures can develop. Okay. I wouldn't say it that way, but that's the kind of the perception. And then he continues. It's interesting, however, that a personal hierarchy often develops in the shadow of the holacratic formal structure. So that the kind of thing that we want to get rid of kind of gets reintroduced to the back door. That's kind of the criticism here. And he says, in the simplest variant, it takes place holacratically correct through the combination of central roles in individual people. And then for the moment a person assumes the roles of the signatory for central orders, the internal work dispatcher, the decision maker about salary increases, and the final dismissal, there's actually a kind of personal management by this role holder. Okay, fair enough. And we've seen I've seen these patterns. So what's the problem here? So the problem is you need to any organization also is being held to, at least in Germany, being held to labor law, provisions. So you need to take care of your employees, basically. So if somebody doesn't take holidays or burns out or gets suicidal or whatever, the organization is being held responsible by law. So what that necessitates is a kind of interface between the organization and the people. So the organization needs to have a role, right, that kind of navigates the needs of the organization and the needs of the people and kind of harmonizes both. So we need to kind of, this interface. So traditionally, that's the disciplinary leader in a formal hierarchy, right? That's the boss, that's the manager, and it's pretty clear in those structures. In Holacracy, you kind of need something similar because you the this as long as you don't have other constructs, like legal constructs, where, for example, I worked for ENCO.org. We worked on it under a different structure. We tried to we were all legally managers, so we were all partners of the organization. So there was no employees technically. We were all the owners and managers, co-owners. So that's a different legal construct, which then leads to a different structural requirement, and then also different power dynamic. So, but most holacratic organizations, as far as I can see, have a more traditional legal setup. So there's still like this division between employees and employers. So we need something to manage that boundary. And so you create a role for that, right? And then you put a person in there. And yeah, sure. And if you put the same people, your former managers, you transition to Holacracy, and what usually happens is, you try to map the current structure into a Holacracy, and then you go from there, right? So you say, okay, let's start with what we have, and then slowly, gradually, so and translate it to Holacracy structures like roles and circles. Let's keep the same people where they are, and then just slowly go from, evolve attention by attention, go from there as a starting point. So you translate what you have. So it's perfectly possible to emulate a traditional power hierarchy in Holacracy. It's possible. Not, it shouldn't be the intention, to my understanding. So it shouldn't be, I know, if you re go through the pains of introducing that, why would you want to stay there, right? And so there should be a motivation to move away from there, but you can. So if that means there's a role centralization in terms of the same roles that a person had, kind of, or the same functions, like setting salary and doing performance reviews and whatever, talk, if that stays the same, yeah, then the same things happen. Although it looks on the outside, oh, there's roles and there's nobody's above anybody, and then, but internally it may still, and people may still also bring all their old habits of viewing things the old way. And if it's just really relabeling and nothing changes, there's no real distribution of these responsibilities or into different roles, or there's no alternative processes that how to do these things. If you do, yeah, if you do all the HR stuff in a more or less traditional way, yeah, then you get the same thing, and you just pretend to be, evolved as an organization. So I can get the criticism, but it's not fate. It's just lack of using the tools of that Holacracy actually offers. See, you could make a proposal to change these things. You could go to governance and so on and so forth. And it's the question of is it safe to do that? in a sense, like, is there anybody trying to exert like pressure on you? Hey, don't bring that proposal or else, you know? And that is again dependent on, do the owners or the people of in power that, you know, kickstart the holacracy transformation, do they back the transformation finally? And would they protect it by, you know, kicking out people who are not, you know, who are trying to play the old games? Would they just stand at the sidelines and watch people do fall into their old patterns? And that's a question. Anyway, so that's one of the problems that Kudos point to, and you know, I give him that. That's
Well,
that.
my take is a bit different. I think what really distinguishes holacracy from, I would say, even other self-management frameworks is that it actually allows you to create any organizational structure that suits the purpose of the organization. So in a way, if hierarchy and the traditional structure serves your purpose the best, I mean, you collectively find this as the best fit for the
Well,
purpose that the organization serves, then I think that's allowed. That's perfectly allowed in holacracy, isn't it?
yeah, I mean, although the rules don't fully support all of the old ways of doing things,
No, yeah,
so cannot command around people.
well, if
You
you
can
mean,
try, and
you but
if they
Dennis,
don't.
if we agree that my role is to be boss and your role is to obey.
Yeah, right, but that's just an kind of there's no way to
I
do
understand it's like it's very ludicrous proposal, but in a way it wouldn't go against the essence of.
that. It would against this, I would think it would go against the spirit of Holacracy, what Holacracy is actually
Yeah, I
about.
understand.
But it's not, you know, as you say, it might, you know, even I say that sometimes centralizing roles in people, you know, in, let's say you transition to a holacracy and you have these few people who have been managers and have, you know, had all the problems escalated to them, and they really develop some serious problem solving skills because they had to, right? And
That's a
everybody
tension.
else didn't have to,
But
so
that's a tension
they
then.
huh?
That's a tension then. Then we resolve this tension, and maybe it's not the best design of the circle.
Well, anyway, let's assume that that was the case, that, you know, certain people had to were trained by the system to, you know, make decisions and be good at it, you know, and others were trained to defer to other people slash roles, whatever, and you know, didn't have the chance or the need to become better at certain things, like deciding about this or that. So and once you transition, you still need those things, and so you need so the same person might be still the best fit, although it's a centralization of very important roles, like the ones they had before, right? But you know, if you stay, that's it. That's why I say for a transition, for the beginning, it might be even appropriate to leave the old manager in that role because they are capable of doing things. But then it's a question as do we really want to change? Do we want to distribute power more across more people? That's because that's kind of possible and kind of I think the goal of Holacracy, that to empower everybody more. So that those people get thrown into those roles that were, you know, not thrown, but invited into those roles where they can grow into developing those capacities that formerly only one person had, because only one person had to do that or was, you know, was the boss or manager. And then now more people do these kinds of things, and it's more on a eye level. But that's a transition. That's not a, you cannot put a switch. The dirty little secret is, after you signing the constitution, not much things change immediately. It's you work against whole habit patterns and all that, and you really have to want to go somewhere with this. If you,
Just one comment more about this. I was thinking like that there must be a kind of like this urge or this need or this kind of like tension, if you will, from the system, from the whole kind of like design of how we work together, so that it would push then slowly but surely towards more distribution of authority. I think it has to come from inside. So it's not like it's almost like an adaptation process for the whole organization to find the right fit, and it might change all the time as well. I mean, if we are in a crisis, it might be good if someone really takes the lead and has more authority. But when we are in a kind of like a stable, more stable stage of development, obviously it might be better to decentralize.
Well, I think it should be tension driven to totally, and the thing, but there's a problem too, because we all have been socialized the old way. So that means we might even feel have kind of have you know we might f some part of us might feel the tension, but it's kind of frozen. So we're numb. We're still numb to tension because we never were invited to process tensions because we never thought we, all kinds of, suddenly we're all invited to co-create the structure of our circle, at least, or all the circles we're involved in. And that has not been the case before, only if we were top management. Top management could think about, departments and role descriptions and all that stuff, job descriptions and so on. But not the base, not the people on the shop floor. But now they, and with Holacracy, they are all invited to do that, and it's and we are equipped with an organizational language, pattern language, that all of us can use now. But we also have to learn how to use those things and what they can do for us. And you have to kind of find your way into it. And it's like, oh, if I have this problem, and I can actually use this new tool from this new toolkit, and it actually helps me. And that takes a while until you get there, until you make that experience, and then you were motivated, more motivated to learn and pick up like the pathways, and that Holacracy offers you to process your tensions. And in first of all, you have to get. Feel that you have the permission that to actually do something about those things that you formerly kind of wanted to do something about, then got frustrated because nothing happened. But you told your manager and they said, yeah, I'm gonna take care of this, and nothing happened. So you just kind of gave up and resigned and just, okay, I'm gonna just do what is absolutely required and nothing more. That's kind of the attitude in a lot of organizations today.
This is one of the topics that I've encountered as well, that when you implement Holacracy in an organization that has already kind of strong history and culture within the traditional kind of hierarchical structure, it's pretty difficult to get people out of their learned helplessness stage. This I think is a real, like a real thing, real phenomenon, because it's in a way it's a comfort zone as well. It's like I'm quite comfortable in this situation where I do not even have to worry about certain things, take initiative too much, or
So holacracy can only work well if all sensors wake up throughout the organization. We are all in our role sensors for the overall of the organization. And later in my book, I also talk about polarities and polarity management, and in the sense that if you have a any imbalance in a polarity, you get to experience the negative sides of one pole of that polarity. And if those sensors that sense that don't do anything about it or numb, then you get it only gets worse. So you need everybody to be, alert and awake, where they are, wherever they are in the organization, and willing and ready and capable to use the tools that the Constitution grants them to do something about it, because that's the uncomfortable truth about holacracy too. There are no victims anymore. Anyone can help themselves if they really, are not, I don't know, if there's not absent any threats of being fired or whatever. Not to say that those might not exist in under the shadow in the shadows in holacratic organizations. They might, but absent those, you have a lot of possibilities. You have a lot of freedom. But you also have a lot of duties. So holacracy is also it's just an uncomfortable practice in a way.
Yeah,
You can't hide anymore. It's hard.
I mean that the holacracy's view on human nature is very proactive and has a strong agency.
It sees humans as capable of taking on, it sees workers as grown-ups, basically. It treats them as grown-ups. And I think Brian also used to say back then, and his partner Lex, legacy is work for grown-ups. So, and that phrase stuck with me, and I always thought about this. It's like assuming that, not just that you can lead your role and fulfill the expectations that you took on when taking on a role, because taking on a role also is voluntary in holacracy. People tend to not see that or forget that, but if you take on a role, you say, "Yeah, I'm going to do that role," and the person that is giving you that role, the circle leader of the circle, usually, they are also saying, "Yes, you are capable. I trust you are capable of doing that role without me." And when you, as long as you have that role, I cannot tell you what to do in that role. I can make pitches and I can ask projects and prioritize the work if needed. But other than that, you prioritize yourself, you make your own decisions, and that's that. That's all. And if I want to stop you from doing the work the way you do it, then I have to take the role from you. You have to remove you from the role. But that's kind of an escalation point that anyway, but until then, you can do your stuff. So that's the role part. The other part of it is of the grown-up part is so you are all grown-ups. That also means the interpersonal conflicts you experience at work, you don't run to the manager anymore. There's no you grown-ups figure it out for yourself, right? So you can, it's not that we wouldn't want to support our colleagues in let's say mediation, or we might even create a role for mediation of conflicts or something like that. But if it's truly just interpersonal, hey, it's not the function of the manager or the circle lead to resolve that. No, you can do it. That's then we have to all, become more adult at work.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know what you think about that, but I think that whenever you are working in a holacracy powered organization, there are two processes that happens. One is that obviously you will have all these different kind of practices and tools that you can use in order to perform better together. But another dimension, I think, is also like your personal development. I mean, as a person, as a personality, as a, you know, human being, like it's I think these are parallel kind of developmental dimensions. I don't know what you think about.
Yeah, I think holacracy is a tremendous kind of catalyst and can be a tremendous catalyst and trigger where people say, oh, the way holacracy taught me to manage my boundaries as a role filler, that helped me with my whatever, my psychological work. Like, holacracy, I think Brian cites participants that said, they came to him and said, hey, you know, what I learned in holacracy in 3 months is surprised my therapist with, you know, with all these insights I brought from this other practice, right? It's like, yeah, you know, what can you expect and what can you not expect of me? Where do I say no? Because in holacracy, you have to, you know, you get to assess, is this, you know, does this, do I think this is work that's falls under my role? Is this within or within my purpose or not? Is this my accountabilities or not? You get to interpret that, and you get to say no to work that is being offered to you to take on. And you know, and you're really clear, is this a formal request to a role because of the accountabilities of the purpose, or is this just the pitch, right? Is this, are you just advertising your, you would like me to do something, and I could do it if it's a favor. I would even do it, maybe, but you cannot expect it like on an ongoing basis. And that clarity is just brilliant, you know. And that's really also then seeps into, hey, why don't we are more explicit with our expectations as spouse and husband or whatever, and in the personal life, hey, you have this implicit expectation of me emptying the dishwasher, but we have never talked about this. We never, let alone wrote anything down, which could help, you know, potentially. And yeah, and people also really have a different, start to relate to conflict and tensions in a different way, because just the word tension is a reframe of an unpleasant experience, right? So you have an unpleasant experience. Something is not right here, right? You feel it bodily, and so is this some kind of cramp or some kind of contraction that you run into, and then some impulse in you emerges. Oh, I want to do something about it. That is a tension, and holacracy helps us to frame it in a, let's say, relatively neutral way. Say, okay, attention is something you wanted, you know, where you say something is not as it could be and you want it to be different. That's all it is. And the more the distance between those two things, the bigger the tension, right? So you want to reduce the tension, and having attention is a sign of life, actually, that you're alive. If you don't feel attention, you're dead. You're, you know, in a coma, and then you don't have tensions. Great, but you know, that's not a good state for an organization to be in, nor is it for you as a human being to be in. You don't want to be walked all over like a doormat. But if you feel attention, you want to, you know, find a way to express that and resolve that.
I love that that I think all of the people experience tensions, right? At different levels. But it's quite difficult for people to be aware of them and also name them, or somehow like bring them to life in a way, look at them from a distance and say, okay, what is this that I'm actually experiencing right now?
That breaks the spell, because otherwise you're just brooding in it. Oh, this asshole, whatever, or this idiot doesn't do what I think he should be doing, and so on. And then you don't even realize that you are having attention. The tension has you, right? It has you. So the subject object is not, is all kind of messed up in a way. So you have to make this tension a object of you, the subject, in a sense, so you differentiate So what Halaxy does is differentiate role and soul, the person from the organization, and it without privileging one over the other, as Kugel claims in his book. So he claims it's role over soul. I correct him on that, but that's not the way it's meant in Holacracy, and it's certainly not the way I live it or my colleagues live it or I've seen anyway. But yeah, this differentiation is a very important thing, and Holacracy helps you make certain things object through the language it introduces, the language of tensions. So you have this unpleasant experience that you otherwise would just like to push away, and then Holacracy, no. Turn it into fuel. It's fuel. It's rocket fuel. You could channel it into meaningful change, and you could use the energy in that tension and make a proposal how to make it better, make it different, and you can even be grateful for attention because it helps you learn. And this reframe is just huge. It's huge on a personal level. In anything that you resist persists, but if you look at it with attention and awareness, so in that sense Holacracy is also an awareness practice for the organization. So you it's a kind of, I wouldn't say meditation for the organization, but it's close in a sense. If everyone just wakes up as a sensor and is focuses on the present tensions, the tensions that are present right now. Not the future tensions, not the past tensions. If you don't feel them anymore, they're past. But if they're there, the tensions that are alive for you now, and if you manage those and resolve those, then you develop and you grow as an organization. You grow as a person if you do that. If you don't push stuff under the carpet or, into the cellar or whatever. But if you face things ruthlessly, as Brian always like to say, ruthlessly facing reality, that's hopefully what Holacracy helps you do. So because by facing it, you are accepting the existence of the not no longer problem, but tension, right? So you reframe it as the problem as a tension. And this way, you can open up to it and become curious. How? What could I do? How could we resolve this? How could we prevent it from happening again? How could we? But also, tension is not just negative. It's also the chance, the positive potential. Hey, we could invent this new product, and we could enter the new market. It's also attention. I want to do something about it. It's not as good as it could be. So let's. I feel tense and excited in a way about this tension because I want to do something with it, right? Yeah, so that's all in there, and I don't know how we ended up here.
No, it's good. It's good, Dennis. It's all good. It's all good. I love the kind of like a switch from problem to tension to solution. I think it's a good way of looking at how the holacracy helps you to be more solution focused. Okay, so one other one more criticism that I would like to hear your take on is about bureaucratization, about well, I think holacracy has been called as a bureaucracy 2.0, something like that. So what's your take on it?
Yeah, Holacracy does have elements that help you formalize structures, right? So that's the part of the power of it. It's not to say let's throw out all structures, but to let's use structure wisely to make things more efficient. Because you could go, and I do this in the book. I go through this. Let's see, you could differentiate three stages, let's say. So you have bureaucracies, no, the old classical stiff, traditional rules and policies and organizational handbook is like a three telephone books sect together or something like that, and nobody it's stifling, and nobody can do anything without, you know, getting something filed, and everything is documented, and there's whatever, you know, it's just stifling, you know, a lot of red tape, and nobody can do anything. And then people said, let's break free, let's, you know, let's go post bureaucratic, let's do the informal thing, you know, let's crush the structures and be wild and free, and, you know, get things done, and, you know, be like a startup and whatnot. And it's, yeah, there's something to it, but it's also you know, the freedom, and that's, it's a polarity, you know, right? So the polarity of informality and formality, I'll call it. So you have the advantage. So let's go to polarity management. It's a big part of my book. So polarity management is a perspective from Barry Johnson, a model of by Barry Johnson. He's an organizational consultant, and so he developed this model where you would look at, he says there's two things in the world, there's, or not two things, but there's on the one hand you have problems that need a solution, and they can be solved, but not all of them are really problems. Some of the problems you think are problems are actually polarities, and you cannot resolve them because they consist of two interdependent parts, the poles of the polarity, that necessitate each other, and they are not reducible to each other, and they are just in a dynamic flow. So the best you can do is to manage them. You cannot resolve the paradox of, let's say, formality and informality, or structure and freedom. But you have to you know, navigate it. You can navigate, learn to navigate this wisely. So yeah, so in Holacracy also we have, I would say, a lot of polarities that are being covered, and I look at a lot of them in my book. I look at transparency versus confidentiality. You know, there's a value to transparency, but there's also a value of confidentiality. You don't want to blurt out everything for everyone at every time. So there's, it's not an absolutism, and there's a value to decentralization. Like, we didn't centralize power, but what many people don't know, there's also, we also have ways to pull things together and create alignment in Holacracy, which is a centralizing force. You know? So it's not just that we distribute authority, we also have ways of recentralizing efforts, let's say. And that's important. You cannot, you know, otherwise you just fall apart. You know, it's all fragmentation. Everybody does their own thing. That's not what it's meant to be, a holacratic organization. That's the mess. So you go from bureaucracy, where you have the upsides of bureaucracy, which is structure, clarity, and so on, to the downsides. You know, you do too much of the good thing, and it becomes a bad thing, which is, then it stifles you, it hinders you, it you know, you want to break free. So you switch over to the other side, to the other pole. So you say, to hell with all the formal structures. Let's do, you know, informal. You know, we all know each other, etc. And we do our, you know, agile ways of doing. And we trust each other, and we replace formality with trust. Problem is, it can get chaotic because you know, we may have different assumptions about what we can expect of each other, or how things should go, and we're not always in a consensual mode, and there's a tyranny of consensus emerging, and it slows, everything has to be discussed with everyone. You know, something that Holacracy, the problem that Holacracy addresses by setting up clear roles with clear authorities, you know, because then they can just act without having to ask everyone if they're okay with something. So yeah, you have the disadvantages of the let's say, post-bureaucratic freedom and wildness that you have. And I think the next evolutionary step is to bring those two things together. So bureaucracy 2.0, I even write about this in my book, because this is a term that has been brought up by, I think, some researchers. Is holacracy kind of a bureaucracy 2.0? I would say it's a well, in the best case, it's a well-managed polarity of formality and informality. So what is the aspects of informality, the upside? So you can think of the polarity in a polarity diagram. Polarity diagram is like four quadrants. You have on the left side, you have a pole in the middle, and on the right side, you have a pole in the middle. And the upper two quadrants are the positive aspects of each pole, and the lower quadrants are the negative aspects of each pole. And then in between, there is a infinity symbol. So you have this eight, the lying eight, and it shows you the direction that the system flows between those poles, the polarities. So first, it's like the breath polarity. So breathing in, is, you breathe in, you have get fresh air. It feels good until it doesn't. So you go from from, let's say, you have on the left breathing in, it feels good. You inhale, get fresh oxygen, but then too much carbon dioxide builds up in your blood, so you move down to the lower half of the quadrants. And then you want to switch over to the other side of exhaling, because it feels good to clean out your carbon dioxide from your blood. So you do that, you breathe out. Ah, great. And then, breathing out is a solution. No, it's not the solution. It's just the temporary polarity that makes sense now. And then you feel the negative effects of breathing out, which is, lack of oxygen. So you want to go back over to the other pole. So it's this
Continuous movement between
continuous
different
movement,
polarities.
breathing in and breathing out. And the wicked thing is, it's very obvious for us, and if we look at this, at the breathing process, it's very obvious. But it's not at all obvious if you look at centralization versus decentralization in organizations, because you might tout one as the solution, and it might be the solution even for like more than a year or two. It's not like you find out in 2 seconds that, or in 30 seconds, that it's not really a solution, but you have to, kind of move between those. But it's more evident in this biological breathing cycle than within the kind of the time frame of organizational changes. So you might have these, and I analyze the well, I don't really analyze the history of management, but I follow Kühl as he, when he says that, there's these hypes, these management hypes, or he calls it fashions, the management fashions that come and go, and they come back after a few years, like 10 years later, they come back under a different name, but they're structurally the same. And I would say, yeah, because they cover the poles of a polarity, and but no one looks at the whole, and in a sense gets both pole covers both poles. And that is the new thing about holacracy, I would argue, is it does cover both poles. It gives you all the things to manage a polarity well. You can still manage it bad, you can still fail, but you have the necessary equipment. You have aspects. Let's take the formality informality thing, and walk you through this. It's one example I do in the book, where I say, okay, what are the things in holacracy that give you the upsides, and how does the downsides of that pole look in holacracy? So let's start with the formality, which is the aspect that let's start with the negative sides of formality. Let's go there because that's what critics do. Let's do this. So what do they see, the critics? So it's overstructuring. Design by mind is a problem. That means if you do governance not based on tensions, but you know what could everything that could go wrong, you try to formalize that and create rules that aren't really needed now, but you fell out of the present mode and go into the predicting mode, and you know that's a problem. You may have too many roles, too many circles, policies, and domains. You may create too much structure and then abandon those structures, which Kuhl calls formality ruins. So you have the ruins of your past governance there, and nobody cares about them because everybody knows that it's not up to date anyway. And yeah, but you also don't remove them. You don't do subtractive governance, which is some a practice I would recommend any credit organization, because you know, once you're new to Alexa, you learn, oh, I can actually add a new role. Cool. I can add a new structure. You learn about adding, but then you're like the teenager that you know learns about, hey, I can buy new clothes from my new pocket money, but you know, and then the cupboard spills over with clothes, and then it dawns upon you, oh, I'm never gonna wear all of these, and you know, I should better get rid of some. And then you do the you know full sweep of the cupboard, but you should have done it all the way along the way to re also remove stuff, right? So the problem is formalization without a cause. You know, there's no actual real lived tension, or the tension comes from a person, not from a role, and so on. So you would try to sort that out. You would want to try to sort that out, and as a good facilitator would do that. There also you misunderstand accountabilities. You think they are permissions to act. Yes, they are, but you can act from purpose. You misunderstood purpose. You don't understand that purpose covers any possible accountability, but you still, because you didn't get the inversion of the authority structure that holacracy does. I always say holacracy does is an inverted authority structure, inverted relative to how authority normally works in organizations, which is everything is forbidden until it's explicitly allowed as a tendency. Whereas in holacracy, everything is allowed, which is not explicitly forbidden. So it's necessary to explicate what is forbidden in holacracy. So you don't need to explicate all the accountabilities on your role. It's not needed. You know, no, you, especially as a role filler, you don't need that. But any other role may come to you and need that because they want to be able to expect something very explicit that is, you know, you may or may not find is in the purpose of your role, but the other person sees that and they want that to be explicit. So what I'm saying is it should be attention based what you explicate, not like try to write up all of the accountabilities that come to mind or something that you could write down. So that's a rookie mistake, let's say. And yeah. So, or another thing is domain grabbing, where people see, oh, you've got a domain on your role. I should have a domain on my role, even though there's no tension that you know, I would have to protect anything that it would be worth protecting. So I put up red tape without a cause, like not really, don't really need that. So, you know, that can happen in holacracy, and it's, you know, a sign that you've gone overboard on the formality pole of the equation. So you would want to go over to the informality pole, and there you find if you play it well, you know, that's the upside of having a lot of autonomy in role. Why? Because you have the golden rule. The golden rule is everything is allowed unless it's explicitly forbidden, which is it's crystal clear where your authority ends. which is the difference to traditional authority structures and the big advantage of holacracy, because it's never clear where your authority ends. You always have to ask. You always have to, make sure and buy in and la 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 and go back, and you never can really act. Whereas in holacracy, say, just go ahead and create tensions for other people. It's fine. They can set up boundaries if they need to stop you, right? So you have a lot of space for initial initiative. You can even break rules, right? You can break rules if they're in the way, under the rule of individual initiative. It's not, you cannot break every rule, but you can break a lot of rules if they're, if it's an emergency and so on. So you have, it's kind of informal in a way. What is also informal is the cultural space is totally unregulated in holacracy. It doesn't tell you anything how to do this, And then you could say, oh, it doesn't tell me how to do this. Yeah, but it also doesn't tell you how to do this. So if you could view it from one side or the other, it's like, oh, it doesn't give me any handrails here. Yeah, but it also doesn't restrict you in any way. You can set it up any way you want. You're a grown up, remember? And then there's also the, I call it the formal informality of purpose. So as I said again, the purpose of your role is vague, usually, and you can interpret it, and you have the freedom to interpret it. And it's the kind of the sign of trust that Luxy gives you. I trust you to make good decisions for your role. And you can use that. So that's the upsides, and some of the of informality. So if you over emphasize that pole, you come into there may be power games. There may be shadow structures, people try to seek influence, the old ways, basically. There may be a lack of transparency if you, act outside your role all the time or hide stuff. If there's role ambiguity, that is a form of informality. Things get invisible. If you have unclear expectations, that's a form of informality, and you don't do anything about them, well, then it's informal. You may have this role centralization and may creep in without you knowing that this might be a problem, and fair point. And you may have stuff like fake governance in the sense that people kind of agree upon what should be the outcome of governance, and then just go through the motions during the governance meeting with an implicit expectation that please don't anybody raise any objections that will be frowned upon. And then of course it's just theater. You don't have, why do the governance at all? It's hollow then, right? So if you do that too much, then you would want to go back to the formality pole, kind of closing the eight. So you have the upsides of the formality in holacracy is the role clarity, the constitution, which is an explicit, set of rules. You have the rule within those. You have the rules of cooperation, which is a big help during everyday work, because you know exactly what you can expect from your coworkers. Hey, you have to give me a projection about when you are gonna get that project done, or you have to give me, yeah, you have to accept any project that falls under your accountabilities, or and you have to, tell me if you say, oh, I don't think this falls under my purpose of my role, then you have to give me a reason. You cannot just say no. You have to tell me why. And you have to have a backlog of all your projects and actions that I could potentially have an insight into any time. Transparency, right? You have the power games then get less necessary because there are official pathways. You could use them. Of course, if you don't know about them, then you try the informal way and you try to influence people. But hey, you can use those explicit formal expectations. You can set new expectations. And if you do that wisely, then you do the minimally required evolution of governance, not the maximum formalization, but you do only what is necessary when it's necessary to clarify. You clarify only what is absolutely essential. And not everything, you don't try to write a program for everything, but you just do it when it's needed. So that's kind of the what I just the walk through this essential point in my book, this formality informality kind of polarity. And the interesting thing that I noticed is that all of this stuff that I told you from the bottom half of that diagram, namely all the downsides, they're all mentioned in, or most of them, in Kuhl's book.
Okay.
And none of the things I mentioned about the upsides are mentioned in this Shadow Organization book. And that is suspicious. It's like, okay, but is it non-existent? But he also doesn't say it's I only I mean, it's fine if you only want to research unintended, unwanted consequences of a management model. I guess that's fine, but then you should say that. You say it's only those aspects I looked at. I didn't look at any of the positive aspects. I didn't want to, and I was not interested in this. And that's fine. It's legitimate, but doing it in a way, saying, "Yeah, here, this is what holacracy is," and pretending it's the whole picture, and without telling you, "No, I intentionally leave out those aspects," or maybe he didn't intentionally leave them out. Maybe he just thinks that is just all the crap. But then, why the hell are people stupid enough to even do it and go through great lengths and efforts of doing this? And why do they think it's a good? That remains then very mysterious. If there's no, there, then you have to assume that everybody's just naive and stupid who's doing holacracy, which I argue is itself naive and stupid.
It's it is. I mean, you can look at any phenomenon in life from a multitude of different perspectives and get a very different outcome depending on your perspective. So I guess it's the same with holacracy. And but your kind of like take through these polarities, kind of reinforced my idea that holacracy is a very flexible and adaptive system, depending on where you are in your current, developmental stage as an organization or team. So you can actually create any type of a structure or any rules that help you to collaborate.
Yeah, and that's also an interesting polarity here. Kuhl criticizes that the rules of holacracy are rather rigid, like he means the constitution. You cannot just change the constitution, despite the fact that everyone changes the constitution, or a lot of organizations, build their own things. And never mind, but I get the point. But yeah, it's because of this stable framework is you can be highly flexible within that framework, right? So you can do, that's what you just said, like you can build anything with that like Lego box of organizational tools, right? And it gives everyone a common language. And the cool thing is even a cross organizational language. That means you can use the solutions that you found in other organizations and import them to some degree, because you speak the same language, you speak the same pattern language of roles, accountabilities, policies, so on. So it's great for inter-organizational learning among the practitioner community. So I see a lot of advantages of holacracy. Kuhl obviously doesn't, but that's fine. And it's not to say that holacracy is the solution to everything. It's certainly not, and it does have, as we said, and as I acknowledged, it does have its potential downsides and its potential pitfalls. If you look at those only, then you will find them.
And there are so many factors that actually play into the, how successful the practice of holacracy is. I mean, it's just it's such a complex kind of set of different dimensions that you have to take into account. So
Right. Yeah, and that's if you maybe want to touch upon the science side of the street, maybe it's a good segue into this. And I agree, there's like it's a multifactorial thing. And what Kuhl does is say, okay, because there's a constitution, there's one factor that's invariant, like the constitution is the same. And that's why you can just, the things that we found in these five organizations are they will be the same everywhere in all holacracy organizations. And I would say, I don't know that's so, maybe to some degree, but the fact, the one factor that he's leaving out and that I criticize in my book, and he has to leave it out because he is not a practitioner, so he doesn't know the perspective from the inside, that is the factor of depth of practice or maturity, practice maturity. Because how could he tell what is mature practice and what is just a rookie mistake? So if he takes rookie mistakes and says these are unintended consequences of holacracy that we shall expect to find everywhere in every holacracy organization, I would say, yeah, and every holacracy organization that practices on that level of maturity. Yeah. It's a modulated through the factor of practice maturity. That's what I would say. So it's not generalizable across the board. And yeah, I don't know if that sticks, but it certainly makes sense to me that future research should get a benchmark on that dimension of, okay, how would we or could we define maturity, and what's the level of maturity in this holacracy organization, and then we can draw conclusions that are more sound and not don't sound like you just want to trash a measure method, which frankly is what it sounds like now. And yeah, so that's my criticism. Also, I think that I mean, what Kuhl did was he purposefully wrote a book to bring back the discourse from the science to the practitioners and to engage. And I think that's great. That's good, because he's not making itself irrelevant as a scientist, but is actually helping to feed back some of the insights, which is important. And I look at another polarity in my book, which is the polarity of practice and research. And I'll give you a quick walkthrough here. So organizational research, the benefits of it is if you on that pole of the polarity, and you're critically observing, you have a keen look at unintended consequences, you're conscious of the history of management, and you have a corrective for practice. So that's the benefits. If you are overemphasizing that, you can become uninvolved and aloof, you can become arrogant and cynical, you can also become irrelevant without dialogue with practitioners, so you're in your academic ivory tower. You can self-immunize against criticism, and you become operationally blind in the sense like, yeah, we've seen it, everything has been there before. And that's, I think, the attitude he has towards holacracy. Yeah, it's just post-bureaucratic organization. That's the label he throws at it. And I would say, no, it's not just post-bureaucratic organization. It's this weird mix that you cannot quite grasp of formal and informal practices that balance each other, that is a well that enable you to do a well-managed polarity. So you go over to the organizational practice side of the street, to the other pole, then you what are the upsides of that are you're actively involved in doing, you're creating, you're bringing improvements into the world, into the world of work, you're creating value, you're innovative, right? Because you innovate. And if you are, too involved or overly identified with that pole, you may become uncritically involved and then euphoric. You become naive and gullible for any marketing claim that any method spouts, including holacracy. You you may become ignorant and forget history, the history of management, or just ignorant that there, have been many, let's say, attempts at self-organization before, or other practices. You may become ignorant of unintended consequences of practice, and you may also self-immunize against criticisms coming from science. So then you go back to the other side, to the critically observing organizational research. So my best case scenario is that those two sides become build I call it antagonistic synergy, which would make both science and practice anti-fragile, meaning we grow through criticism and we grow through being challenged. And I would not want to leave science unchallenged, because science matters to me. I want good science. I want science to inform me about what is true and good, right? Or let's say about what is true. Let's stay there. But I want them to be truthful and inform. And
Well, I think it's quite difficult to grasp holacracy and its possibilities, like multitude of possibilities it presents, because science, I think, or let's say the management scholars I've been having chats about holacracy, that their view is that whenever you talk about a certain type of a structure of an organization, it's a fixed one. And it's so difficult to create to understand that there might be a meta language or meta structure that allows you to actually create different types of structures. And this, I think, this is the idea that is quite difficult. And this allows the movement between polarities.
And I think one other master coach, unfortunately passed away, Bernard Marie Chiquet. He said holacracy is just a He invented this new label for this new type of organization. He said holacracy is just the first form of a constitutional management, form of constitutional management. Which he said, what he meant was, a form that of management that is, follows the rules of a constitution, that kind of transfers power into a different structure, and away from just purse resting in individuals to resting in the rule set. And that is this is new. And we haven't done that. We have done that with states. We know it from states, and monarchy to the constitutional democracy or something, where the monarch ratifies the constitution of the democratic state. And the same happens now in organizations, that the owners of the organization ratify the constitution to empower all the citizens, so to speak, of the organization, namely all the role fillers, the role leads, to actually lead their roles and abide by the same rules that also bind the owners, because the owners want to be bound by those rules, because they No, it's better for them if they're bound by those rules, because they have bad moments and make bad decisions otherwise. And they know, holacracy is better than me in my worst moments. So it's this kind of, it's just like, you don't want to have a constitution that's too easily changed. That's why we have the three-quarter majority is needed in Germany, at least, to change our Grundgesetz, our law here, the our constitution equivalent. So it does not get changed so easily. There's a point, because blood, sweat, and tears were shed to get this thing into place. Now, major world wars and so on. And if you all the bloodshed and tears that went into the project of creating a self-organization that actually works, practice that actually works, if you have shed all these tears, blood, and so on, you would appreciate this document called the Holacracy Constitution, because there's not one iota that isn't where it should be. It's very, the result of a very long evolutionary selection process that has been, checked by the fire of evolution of practice in organizations. So all these learnings have been fed back into it and over and over and over and over into five iterations up to date. So if you get that, then you get why it's invariant, relatively invariant, because it's really balanced. It's really, it disappoints everybody equally. It's everybody hates something about it equally, but they hate different parts. They hate, oh, you can change things too easily. Oh, it's too, no, it's too stiff. No, it's too this or that. So you hear conflicting messages about what's wrong about Holacracy because it's so all over the place because it covers everything. It covers, it's a exquisitely balanced system. Don't want to mess with it on the level of the DNA of it, which is the constitution. So that would be my pitch. But within that, paradoxically, or you can create all kinds of things. As you said, it's super flexible, and it's yeah, it's a new. That's why I say it's a new specimen. Something that, if you have the operationally blindness of sociologists, you would say, no, we've seen that before. It's just a, let's say, it's a formalized variant of a post-bureaucratic organization. No, it isn't. I don't think so. You need a new category. It's something else. So it's something, whatever you want to call it. It's post-bureaucratic, or it's a constitutional management, or it's whatever. Call it whatever, but don't put it into the old drawers, the old categories. So I rest my case.
I like your determination and energy. Okay, that's cool. We have had a great chat. I know our time is coming to an end, and I wanted just to ask, when is the book coming out in English?
Well, yeah, it's always the people that are not asking if, they only ask when.
Of course.
I should seriously consider, but honestly, after working on the book for 1 year in my free time, apart from work, and putting a strain on my family, they were not exactly excited about the next book project. So it might take a while, but I'm looking into it. Maybe let's see how the response to this podcast goes, and if there's demand for this, then and if hey, if anyone knows a publisher that will be interested in this, let me know, reach out to me. I have my page up at denniswittrock.com. You can find me there. You can also, if you speak German, you can order the book from there. So there's all the info about the book there too. You find it, and just reach out to me and let me know if a publisher would be interested in English.
Another option, Dennis, is to write actually about the central thesis, what you just described in this podcast, a kind of an article in a more, maybe, I don't know, HBR or some more practitioner-oriented oriented journal. And that would probably give also kind of a good segue into understanding what's the response, what's the demand, what's the kind of reaction.
I will think about it.
Okay.
Thanks
Anyway,
a lot.
Dennis, it was great chat. Thank you for taking the time, and I wish you all the best, and let the Holacracy thrive.
Yeah, thank you. That
Yeah.
was really stimulating. You got the best out of me, I would feel. A
Thanks.
nice way of listening. Yeah, I enjoy our conversation.
I am a good listener, I know.
Yeah, let's return to this maybe for a future episode or whatever. If something comes up, we'd
Obviously,
love
yeah.
to do that. It'd
Cool.
be great.
Thank you.
Thanks.